I'm very happy now to welcome Richard McCord. He's a journalist, he's founder of the Santa Fe Reporter, and he's author of the new book, No Halls of Ivy, The Gritty Story of the College of Santa Fe, published by LaSallian Christian Brothers. And there will be a book release tomorrow, Wednesday, the 20th of November, at 5:30 in the afternoon at Fogelson Library on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, formerly known as the College of Santa Fe. Welcome, Richard, to the Radio Cafe.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's a great pleasure to have you. Now, this is a book, you introduced this book as a biography of the College of Santa Fe, which didn't have a very long lifespan. It was born in 1947, died in 2009. How did you come to write it?
Well, actually, the Christian Brothers approached me and they commissioned me to write it. And so, they paid me. We didn't need to go around looking for an advance or anything. They paid me as I was working on it. And I was glad to do it. Getting the work was good, and also having a book. They really wanted a book with their full story of that college in it, and I was glad to accommodate them.
So tell us a little bit about that. The Christian Brothers were the founders of this college. How did that come to be?
Well, as you saw in the book, I could go back to the 1600s if I wanted to. That's what the book does. The Christian Brothers order was founded in the 1600s in France by Jean-Baptiste de La Salle. And then it became a very unusual order, because he was a priest himself, but then he found himself setting up these schools, and he started teaching not in the formal Latin, which had been the custom, but in their own language that they spoke on the street. And he said, we could educate them in Latin, but then they'll go home and their brothers and sisters won't know what they're talking about, and their parents won't. But if we educate them in their own language, they can go home and share their knowledge with other people and their friends in the street. And so he was a real innovator in that sense. And then he innovated a whole bunch of other things. And when he founded his order, he set it up not to be priest, not to have a flock, but to be teachers. And that's often not understood about the Christian Brothers. The common misperception is, that they're priests, they're fathers, and they're monks and all kinds of things. But they're teachers. That is their purpose under heaven.
Now, they founded this college, which is the oldest. Is it the oldest college in New Mexico?
It's the oldest official college because, as you know, New Mexico became a U.S. territory in 1848, and then it didn't become a state until 1912. So it was the territorial legislature that chartered the school. A great history in New Mexico, a great figure in New Mexico history was Archbishop Lamy, the famous Archbishop Lamy, who got here in the early 1850s. And he wasn't sent here by the government. He was sent here by the Catholic Church, to watch over the interest of the church. And he got here right after the 25-year Mexican rule had ended. And the Mexicans had won their independence from Spain. And they didn't kill all the leftover Spaniards. They just told them to get out. And they kicked out all the Franciscans who had opened schools. They kicked out all the Spanish priests. And then once Mexico was in control, their capital was down in Mexico City, a long way away. They were very disorganized. They didn't have much money. And then all of a sudden, things just unraveled here. And a whole generation of children grew up illiterate. And Lamy got here, and he looked around, and he said, we don't have any priests, we don't have any teachers, and we barely have any churches, but what we need the most is teachers. So he sent off, he contacted every teaching convent for nuns and, orders for brothers. And there was a convent in Kentucky that immediately sent some nuns out, and they opened the Loretto Academy downtown for girls. But nobody could spare any teaching brothers, nobody in Canada, nobody in America. So he sent an envoy all the way to France, where he was originally from, and he specifically was aware of the Christian brothers. And his envoy got, I think, five Christian brothers to sail the Atlantic in a wooden ship. And then they landed on the East Coast. They took the train as far as it went, which was to Missouri. Then they climbed aboard ox carts and hit the Santa Fe Trail. And eventually got here after. And, you know, they didn't even speak English, much less Spanish. So they were studying Spanish and English as they came. They did know how to teach, but they arrived here, and Archbishop Lamy greeted them, and he gave them a little adobe building downtown, very close to what the cathedral is now. And he said, this is both your living quarters and your school. Go for it. And so they put up some walls. They built, you know, divided it into sleeping quarters and a classroom or two. And then they started educating the young men. Then later in the 1874, I think, the territorial legislature chartered the school, which had prospered at that point. It was called St. Michael's. And they gave it the first charter in New Mexico history. So it's very historical.
Cutting now back to the 20th century and the College of Santa Fe that so many of us listening here in Santa Fe have known, the Christian Brothers made up the faculty of that college for a good deal of the college's history. What were they teaching, and what was the focus? Was it explicitly Christian in any way?
Oh, well, sure. They had a lot of classes in religion, but they really weren't trying to cultivate religious people. They were trying to educate the young men of northern New Mexico, most of whom didn't have hardly any access to education. They were providing a service that the young men of northern New Mexico had pretty much done without. And Brother Benildus, who was the principal of St. Michael's at that time, his great passion was to open a four-year college. And he tried to expand the downtown campus to include a high school and a four-year college. And he got the famed architect John Galmeme to design an overall plan. And he got the Archbishop of Santa Fe and the governor of the state to be co-honorary chairman of a fund drive. And then it failed. It failed miserably. And World War II broke out, and nobody was trying to raise money at that point to build a college. And then most of the young men of Santa Fe joined the military. The tourists quit coming, and a whole bunch of adult workers went to work in shipyards and, in a war-related thing. And Santa Fe had no industry, and the city fathers said, my God, we're going to go broke. And so they went out, and they passed a bond issue, and they went out and bought 200-some-odd acres on the very southern edge of town. And then they told the U.S. government, if you will put something there, a military installation of any kind, we'll sell you this property for $1. And the country was still in the Great Depression, and so the government, that was a bargain. So they paid the $1, and they decided to put an army hospital there, which sounds kind of strange, but it wasn't as strange as it sounded, because the leading killer in the world at that point was tuberculosis. There was no cure for it, and the only thing that seemed to halfway work was a vague concept called altitude therapy, where they had noticed that if you got to a high and warm and dry climate, your chances of survival were better. Nobody knew why, but it worked that way. So they started sending a whole bunch of tubercular patients here, as well as every other kind, people who had suffered wounds in the war, people who were so-called shell-shocked at the time, and everything else. They had operating rooms. They had a mess hall, obviously. They opened a big hospital. It had more than 2,000 beds, and it overnight became Santa Fe's biggest employer. It was the economic salvation of the town. And then when the it was really on the entertainers circuit. All these entertainers came out, you know, like Bob Hope and Groucho Marx and Alan Ladd and Olivia de Havilland and a whole bunch of others to entertain the troops. So it was just a major stop, a very colorful time. And then when the Allies won the war, the government decided to close down everything that was not needed and as quickly as possible to save money. So the war ended in 1945, and within 2 years, the hospital was totally closed. And Brother Bernildes, who had failed in his drive to build a campus downtown, he went down and essentially got half of the property there, more than 100 acres, and a bunch of abandoned military structures, barracks and things. And
which are still there, a lot of them.
A few of them, yeah. Yeah. They've systematically tried to eliminate them, but some are still there.
Yeah.
And he announced that he was going to open St. Michael's College, as it originally was called, in 1947, in the September semester. And a bunch of other Christian brothers, the presidents of the other Christian brothers colleges in America, came out for some kind of a visit. And they looked at all these abandoned military structures and that were built as temporary structures in the first place. And the president of Manhattan College said, "Brother Bernildes, what you're trying to do is very noble. But if you think you're going to open a campus here, you're a damn fool." But he opened
it. But he did.
He did.
Now, when and why did they decide to admit women?
Well, you know, there's so many things that are interesting in this story. I thought it was just going to be a nice piece of work for me and something appreciated by the brothers. And then I thought, well, you know, it doesn't sound all that interesting. There was this little college that was poor when it started, was always poor, only lasted 62 years, went broke in a small town. And, you know, that doesn't sound too interesting. But the more I got into it, everything was, you know, three times, four times more interesting than I thought. Brother Bernildes, among other things, he was a big man. He weighed more than 300 pounds. And in one of their early graduations, he was handing out diplomas on the stage of the old military theater. And he was handing out, he wasn't the speaker, but he was, you know, handing out the diplomas. And he had a heart attack and collapsed on the stage. And that's pretty dramatic. I mean, it's not good, but he didn't die from that, but he died shortly afterward. He was always trying to raise money for the school. And then once he got out of the hospital, he went out and tried to raise some more money, and he died all by himself in a motel room out in Los Angeles. And then the Christian Brothers, the headquarters was in Lafayette, Louisiana, and they said this school is not breaking even, it's costing us a lot of money, we better just close it down. And at that point, the president was one of the original founders, a Christian brother himself, Brother Cyprian Luke, and he went off to Lafayette to try to keep the college open because he knew they were planning to close it. And he talked them into keeping it open. And then he came back here, and he bought some time. And then he needed ways to make money. So they started a weekly bingo night, and the, you know, they got a dispensation to have monetary gambling because it was a charitable organization, and the people came and played bingo, and whoever won, and whoever didn't win was providing money that went into the general coffers. And so they were hanging on through that and other methods. And Brother Luke remained president a long time. He was president for 24 years. And he remembered one time that a woman came and she said, "I want to get an education." And he said, "Well, I understand, but I, you know, we only teach men. That's our mission." And she said, well, it's just not fair. A woman needs an education as much as a man. And he went off and started thinking about it. And he said, I know she's right. So he started kind of surreptitiously sneaking the women in. He started teaching nuns. He started teaching night school. He started slipping them into summer school. And they heard the Christian Brothers Order headquarters in Rome heard about it. And then they sent him a pretty sharp letter saying, you know, you're violating the practices of our order. But I had some good interviews with Brother Luke. He's passed on now, but he was his mind was sharp. His hearing was bad. I had to kind of shout at him, but he was in a trove of information. He said if they really had wanted me to stop, they would have made me. But times were changing, and they just cut me some slack. And then he decided in the mid-1960s to openly declare that women would be accepted as students. And he also changed the name of the college to College of Santa Fe, which was a great blessing to the journalists because St. Michael's High School had athletic teams. St. Michael's College had athletic teams. If you looked at a sports page and it said, St. Michael's loses again, you didn't even know which school they were talking about. And so he got them in, and that was, this school made history in the Christian Brothers Order in so many ways. It was the first to accept women. It was the first to have a woman president a few years later. It was the first to have a lay president because the Christian Brothers Order was running short of people. And their bylaws said the president of the school shall be a Christian brother. And they changed one word in the bylaws to say, shall ordinarily be a Christian brother.
And that did it.
And that enabled them to hire James Freeze to be the first lay president.
Now, this is a book. We're talking about Richard McCord's new book, No Halls of Ivy, The Gritty Story of the College of Santa Fe, that I think should be read by anyone who's considering a career in college administration or who is in college administration, because it really gives you kind of a picture of how tricky it is to run an institution, because so many of the things that affect the institution are out of its control.
Oh,
big
yeah.
Societal changes, big economic changes, big demographic changes, and so on.
Well, that's true. The ironically, if that's the word, World War II enabled the college to exist. Not only did they get the abandoned military hospital, but 80% of their first students came on the GI Bill, which only was established at the end of World War II. And they were only teaching males. So, you know, without the GI Bill and without the abandoned hospital, there would be no college. And then the Korean War was a great problem for them because all the young men were called back into military service and they almost ran out of students. But then later, the Vietnam War was the golden age because the draft was still in effect and all the young men of America were facing the prospect of getting drafted and going over and being in a foxhole in the jungle somewhere.
So they all wanted to go to college.
And if they went to college anywhere, they could get a student deferment.
Right.
They didn't have to go to Harvard or Yale or even UNM. If they got into college anywhere, they would get a student deferment. And so they started applying all over the place to the College of Santa Fe.
Now, how did the college move toward its focus on the arts and film?
Well, that was another historical irony. At first, the College of Santa Fe was providing education, you know, for people who never thought a college would ever be in their life. And then after, with the passage of years, Santa Fe Community College opened, way, way cheaper than the College of Santa Fe. And all these students started going there. And Brother Donald Mouton was the president at that time, and he said, they're teaching, they're drawing away our nursing students, they're drawing away our business students, they're drawing away this and that, our computer students. We're going to have to come up with our own identity. And so he kind of focused on a school for the arts, the performing arts, for the motion picture arts, for artists, you know, with paintbrush and easel, with writing. And he put the emphasis there, and it was brilliant. You know, it did the trick. It became known as one of the best art schools in the country.
And then Greer Garson got involved.
Oh, did she ever? Her husband, she was not only a world-famous star, she was officially the world's most famous star for quite a while. And she married a multimillionaire oil man named Buddy Fogelson. And they met in Santa Fe, oddly enough, through circumstances. And they had dinner, I think, at La Fonda. And he told her at the end of the first dinner, he said, I'm going to marry you someday. And then they did get married. And he had a ranch out in Pecos. And Brother Luke was aware of it. And he sent a man out there to ask if he could donate some money to the college. And Buddy Fogelson got back, sent him a note and said, you know, Brother Luke, why should I get involved? I'm not Catholic. My wife isn't Catholic. I don't live in Santa Fe. And besides, how much money are you getting from your own archbishop? And the archbishop was kind of giving them nothing. But Buddy Fogelson, look, I'll tell you what. If you get $5,000 from your archbishop, I'll give you another $5,000. And so Brother Luke got the $5,000. And then he notified Buddy Fogelson, and Fogelson said, you'll have a check from my Tulsa office within a week. And then that was...
then it went on from there.
It went on. It started with $5,000, and then before it was over, it went past $5
million. Right. And wonderful facilities that are still there. And, you know, you detail in your book the ups and downs kind of year by year, decade by decade, and everything seemed to be going well, and then suddenly, or maybe not suddenly, but it seemed suddenly, in the first decade of the 21st century, the college had a deficit. It was in the millions, and then the tens of millions, and whoever was supposed to be watching the numbers seems to have been asleep at the switch. It's just mind-boggling that the college could go from this successful, accredited, well-respected, sought-after college with all kinds of, you know, wonderful and vibrant students to being tens of millions of dollars in the hole and just having to close.
Well, they... Brother Luke, who was there for 24 years, he did a real good job. First, he held the place together, and then he was a pioneer, groundbreaker. And then, after 24 years, people were saying that he's outworn his usefulness. They started saying that he had, he was an example of the Peter principle, saying that no matter, if you're good at something, they'll promote you, and then if you're good at that, they'll promote you, and eventually you go past your level of competence.
Right, which happens every single day 10,000 times all over the world.
I bet you it does. So he was under a lot of pressure to step down, and he announced one day after 24 years, he said, I will not seek a new contract. So Jim Freeze, who was the next president, he did a good job. But then there was a series after he was there for a long time, about 12 years. And but then there was a whole string of not such good presidents after that. And the college, the finances started unraveling, and the identity of the school became murky. And it just, the presidents didn't do a good job, and then they left.
And no one was reading the financials.
Yeah.
That's what blows my mind.
Yeah. The board of directors was kind of asleep on its feet, and they just ran up huge deficits, and they couldn't pay it. And so all of a sudden it was faced with just simply going bankrupt.
And all these things happened. I mean, you go through the decline and fall and the possible solutions to keep the college open, blow by blow. It's like watching a movie whose ending you know, but you still read it and it's, you know, it's gripping and you keep watching it. Got to give some big kudos to Mayor Koss for his save on this one.
Well, they went to they asked the legislature to take it over.
And Richardson was completely into it.
Richardson, the governor, was behind it. But the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee wouldn't even hold a hearing on it. And then, so the proposal went nowhere. The legislature passed on it. And then they had their last graduation. The campus was being boarded up, and Richardson appointed a committee to try to save the campus in some way. And then Santa Fe Mayor David Koss, who was on this committee, he went down one day and he said, I'm proposing that the city pass a bond issue and buy the entire campus. And then we'll lease it to somebody, because if that place goes dark and is abandoned, it's going to be 10 years of real estate wars.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. The city council approved it. The city now owns the campus. And a for-profit educational company called Laureate leased the facility and is running a school out there now.
And the focus is still on the arts and filmmaking and theater and so on. So what happened to the remaining Christian brothers?
Well, for the most part, they kind of got old and died. There are a few still around. Brother Donald Mouton lives here. There's a Christian Brothers dormitory or residence, they call it, at St. Michael's High School, where some of them live. But for the most part, the order aged. They aren't getting very many new Christian Brothers now. And so the order does provide a residence for them here in Louisiana or some other places. But for the most part, they just kind of have retired or gotten old or moved away or died.
The book is called No Halls of Ivy, The Gritty Story of the College of Santa Fe, published by the LaSallian Christian Brothers. Richard McCord is the author. He's a journalist. He's a founder of the Santa Fe Reporter. And he will be at the book release event tomorrow, Wednesday, the 20th of November at 5:30 at the Fogelson Library on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And one of the nice things about reading the book is you actually meet the people after whom all the buildings are named.
That's right.
But anyway, thanks for the terrific book, and thanks for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Well, it certainly was enjoyable.
We're going to take a little break now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe.